Good evening, my dear brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and our dear young people. Well, it is, I suppose, with a deal of sadness that we come to our concluding study, and yet we are thankful, aren't we, that our awareness has been heightened to the life of that great man, Jonathan, and the lessons and the exhortations in his life which our brother Roger has brought forth for us. Let us then, brethren and sisters, join as we pay our respect and thankfulness to our Heavenly Father together as we commence our meeting with the singing of Hymn 3. As a basis, brethren and sisters and young people, of our consideration tonight, we are going to call now upon Brother Scott Wright to read for us 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 17 to 27.
Reading together with you, brethren and sisters and young people, the second book of Samuel, chapter 1, verses 17 through to 27, David's lament for Saul and Jonathan. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away. The shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turn not back, and the sword of Saul return not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished?
At our study this afternoon, we left Jonathan slain on the mountains of Gilboa. And we come now this evening to consider David as he gives vent to his feelings for those two men, both Saul and Jonathan. And our brother Roger will speak to the subject, Jonathan the Mighty, Memorial Lamentation and Final Peace.
Thank you, Brother Chairman. My dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people, all stories have a conclusion. And in the 2 Samuel chapter 1, and in the lamentation of David for his friend Jonathan and for his father Saul, we have almost, but not quite, the end of the story concerning this wonderful and glorious man. We concluded our last study with Jonathan, as our presiding brother has rightly said, lying now slain upon the slopes of Gilboa because he had chosen to do that which he thought would best advance the cause of the truth. And you know, if you really stop and think about what Jonathan did, you'll find that there was no other way. Any other solution would have been less than ideal in being faithful to God, faithful to his father, and faithful to his friend. It was the best choice. And he chose it unerringly and unhesitatingly and with the spirit of selfless love that is so characteristic of him. And you know the story as well as I do, that it wasn't until David came back from the matter of the tragedy that had befallen him and his army of men at Ziklag from the smiting of the Amalekites, it wasn't until David came back from that that he learned the story of the overthrow of the army of Israel on Mount Gilboa. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, there's something that really struck me about this story, and that's this, that you'll remember that David was called to come up with the Philistines. He came up with Achish, king of Gath. He would have been in a position whereby he would have had to fight against his own people. And it wasn't until the five lords of the Philistines passed by that they said, "Who is this Hebrew amongst us?" And Achish said, "He's a good man. He's been with me." And the lords of the Philistines said, "We don't trust this man because he might change and show his allegiance again to his own people at the last minute and so fight against us." And so the record tells us that the Philistines decided to send David away. And David must have, as it were, wiped his brow in relief as he realized that he'd been able to, with very little difficulty as it were, because of the interposition of God, to get out of what would have put him in a very, very difficult position. In fact, that would have placed him against his own kith and kin, as it were, against the armies of Israel. But it wasn't until later, until he'd come back and heard the story of the overthrow, that David would be forever grateful to the hand of providence that had plucked him away from the scene of that battle. How could David have lived afterwards with his conscience if he had known that he had participated in the battle in which his dearest friend had fallen? How could David have ever lived with that if he'd fought in that battle? David would have forever plagued his mind with the feeling that it might have been because of his men that the balances had been tipped in favor of the Philistines and against Israel. David must have been forever grateful for the hand of God that plucked him out of that situation, and he didn't appreciate that till later on, as we come now to the 2 Samuel chapter 1 and to the story then of the lament with which David lamented this tragedy upon Mount Gilboa. And we're told in the 17th verse, "And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. And also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher." When it says in the 18th verse, "He bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow," many of us will be aware that the words "the use of" are in italics. It should be rendered simply, "He bade them teach the children of Judah the bow." The Revised Version translates the phrase "the song of the bow." The New International Version says that he ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. And whether we add an extra word in there, such as the word "song" or "lament," it doesn't really matter. Either way, we believe that the phrase "the bow" is the title of the lamentation that David composed on this occasion. He bade them teach the children of Judah the bow. That's the name of the song. And the theme of the bow stood for two things. It stood for the overthrow of the house of Benjamin, and also for the tragic death of Jonathan. It represented both those ideas. There is a twinning of ideas in this lamentation. The song of the bow is at once the memorialization of the overthrow of the house of Benjamin and a personal song of grief for the death of Jonathan. Now let's just have a look at that then in Scripture. First of all, let's look at the connection of the bow and the reference to the tribe of Benjamin. Now you see here that in the first of Chronicles, chapter 8 and verse 40, the record says, "And the sons of Ulam were mighty men of valor, archers. All these are of the sons of Benjamin." 1 Chronicles 8, verse 40. In the 2 Chronicles, chapter 17, and verse 17, the record says, "And of Benjamin, Eleazar, a mighty man of valour, and with him armed men with bow and shield. In the first of Chronicles, chapter 12, and verses 1 and 2, in a reference that we've already looked at, they were among the mighty men, helpers of the war. They were armed with bows and could use both the right hand and the left in hurling stones and shooting arrows out of a bow, even Saul's brethren of Benjamin. And in the second of Chronicles, chapter 14 and verse 8, Asa had an army of men that bear targets and spears, and out of Benjamin that bear shields and drew bows, 24,000, all these were mighty men of valour. So you see, the theme of the bow in the first instance commemorated the tribe of Benjamin, who were particularly famous for their use of that weapon. And now the house of Benjamin had been overthrown. The bow of Benjamin, as it were, had been broken. In a sense, it's the spirit of Hosea chapter 1 and verse 5. Listen to these words. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And those words uttered in the prophecy of Hosea, chapter 1 and verse 5, had their foreshadowing on an earlier occasion when in that same valley the bow of Benjamin had already been broken once before, as the royal scepter was to pass from Benjamin and be given over to Judah. And you see, I believe that David understood that. He appreciated that this was a momentous moment in the history of the nation when the promise of Genesis chapter 49 was about to be fulfilled and the scepter would pass to the house of Judah from the house of Benjamin. And so the Song of the Bow is the lamentation of the fact that the house of Benjamin has been overthrown, the bow of Benjamin has been broken, and the scepter has been given to Judah. And you see the point then of verse 18 when it says, he bade them teach the children of Judah. The New International Version says, he ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. Now, why did David order the men of Judah that they be taught? Someone says, well, that's the only tribe he was governing at the time. That may be true. But you see, I think the reason that David called upon Judah to sing this song was because, you see, the royal scepter was passing to them from Benjamin. And the reason, therefore, for the teaching of the house of Judah that they should learn this song was that they might understand that there is no joy in the downfall of brethren, even if they have opposed us. I'll say that again. He bade the children of Judah sing this lamentation for the overthrow of the house of Benjamin, to teach Judah that there is no joy in the downfall of brethren, even if they have opposed us. Even if we consider that they have opposed the truth. The downfall of brethren is always a tragedy for the truth. And David said to the men of Judah, I want you to sing this song and appreciate that principle. But it was more than that. It was also the song of the bow because it was a personal lamentation for Jonathan. Now, what do we know concerning Jonathan? The bow of Jonathan. Well, you see, the bow of Jonathan was emblematic of the man himself. Keen of eye, steady of hand, champion in a tribe that were already collectively famous for their prowess with this instrument. The bow of Jonathan is a theme that comes right through the story of his life. In the first of Samuel, chapter 14 and verse 14, according to the Septuagint translation, his bow was used to achieve a wonderful victory by faithful courage. In the 18th chapter in verse 4, his bow was used to render a gracious act of self-effacement. Remember when he gave his bow to David? In the 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 36, his bow was used to offer a secret signal of poignant warning to his dear friend. And in the 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 22 in this very song, his bow was used to give a final proof of total loyalty to the truth, as no doubt he used it wisely and well in the battle on Gilboa. And so you see, the song of the bow is a song that is a personal lamentation for the loss of Jonathan. It's the very essence of the man. It is both a national tragedy and an outpouring of David's personal grief for the loss of his friend. And it's a song that's broken into a series of uneven sections. I tried to look at breaking up the song, and there's been two or three different suggestions made as to how the song should be broken up. But it seems to me that when you read the story of this lamentation carefully, that there is no real satisfactory breakup of the song, because you see, it's the words of grief-stricken recollection as David hurries from one thought to another and then to another, and there's no particular order. It's simply the outpouring of his grief. One thought crowding in upon another and going back to central ideas that pluck at his heartstrings. But here's what it covers all the same, in a general sense. In verse 19, we have a lamentation for national defeat and for Jonathan's sad end. In verse 20, a heartfelt plea to mourn in private for the truth's sake. In verse 21, a bitter imprecation called down over Gilboa's fateful heights where this tragedy had occurred. In verse 22, a warm mention of Saul and Jonathan's bravery and courage on the battlefield. In verse 23, David's deep appreciation of Jonathan's chosen course which he had executed. In verse 24, a generous recollection of Saul in happier times. In verse 25, personal despair over Jonathan's tragic death. And in verse 26, a memorial valediction for Jonathan's deep and sacrificial love. And finally, in the 27th verse, a final repetition of the lamentation's key refrain. There's all sorts of ideas there. And I don't think it was a structured poem in the sense of being all carefully worked out. It's the outpoured sobbings of David's heart. And this is what he says in the 19th verse. He says, "The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen?" The word beauty, of course, is an unusual word. It's the same word translated in the next chapter, in the 2 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 18, as roe. There were three sons of Zeruiah, Joab and Abishai and Asahel, and Asahel was as light of foot as a wild roe. And the word roe there, in the 2 Samuel 2 and verse 18, is the same word translated beauty in chapter 1 verse 19. And the roe, or the gazelle, was a symbol of grace and beauty, an innocent, pretty creature, nimble and sure-footed upon particularly the high places. And I think in this particular context, the term the beauty of Israel in verse 19 no doubt has reference both to Jonathan and to his father, although I think that David has Jonathan mainly in mind, because you see, he says, "The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places," and he repeats that phrase in verse 25, doesn't he? "O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places." And so whilst the reference to the beauty of Israel probably does reach out to embrace both father and son, it was Jonathan in particular that he had in mind. And you see, what we have here is the final scene of tragedy, as the verse 19 says, slain upon thy high places. And of course, the high places of the verse are the fateful heights of Gilboa, the scene of the final tragedy. And the image presented in this verse is that of a graceful animal struck down on the very heights that it frequents, where it ought to be the most sure-footed. And as the gazelle bounced along the heights of the mountains, we have the image of that beautiful animal struck down, lying still on the very mountains that it frequents. David could no doubt imagine that scene so vividly in his mind. And so he says in the very next phrase, how are the mighty fallen? Ike Nafalu Gibborim. And it becomes the cry which is the basis of the whole of this song of lamentation, as he sees Jonathan lying upon the high places of Gilboa in his mind. How are the mighty fallen? You see the same phrase in verse 25, but this time expanded. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? And then again, finally, at the end of the song of lamentation, in verse 27, now augmented to become a full couplet, how are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? And so that phrase is really the key refrain of the whole of the song. How are the mighty fallen? David's expression of grief and despair, in particular, at the loss of his dearest friend. Verse 20. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. And the very phrase, tell it not in Gath, is taken up as a proverb by Micah in chapter 1 and verse 10. Why Gath and why Ascalon? Well, there were five cities of the Philistines, of course, weren't there? There was Gath and Ascalon and Ekron and Gaza and Ashdod. And I think what probably happens here is that two of the five cities are taken as representative of the whole. Two of the chief cities representing all of the Philistines. Gath perhaps because of David's association. Gath perhaps because that was where Goliath came from. And there's been a dreadful reversal here from chapter 17. When the head of Goliath was taken and paraded through the streets of Israel, as it were, and now the head of Saul has been paraded through the streets of the Philistines instead. The whole story's reversed. Tell it not in Gath, says David. Ascalon is considered to be the site of the temple of Ashtaroth. And we're told in the divine record that that's where Saul's armor was taken. The site of the temple of Ashtaroth in Ascalon. And so David says, tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. And there's a tone of bitterness there, you see, because the word publish in verse 20, it literally translated means bring good tidings. That's the real meaning of that word. Don't bring the good tidings into the streets of Ascalon. Oh, that was a bitter use of that term. And of course, the reality of the matter, of course, is the very opposite. Because if we turn back a page to the 1st of Samuel 31 and verse 9, we read that they cut off the head of Saul and stripped off his armor and sent into the land of the Philistines roundabout to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. To publish it. Same word. David's cry was that it might not be published in the streets of Ascalon. The reality was that the overthrow of Gilboa was published throughout all the region of Philistia. And David must have known that. So why did David make a plea in verse 20, that the matter ought not to be published in Gath or Ascalon, when he knew full well that they all did know? And the answer is that the 20th verse is, as it were, David's wish that if it were possible, that Israel might be spared the degradation of Philistine triumph. If possible. It's a heartfelt plea to mourn in private for the truth's sake. David's spirit was to conceal what had happened, not to publish it. How often has it happened in ecclesial life where someone who's been the bitter enemy of someone else in the truth has fallen in some way and the matter is published abroad? How easy it would have been for David to do that. He says, tell it not, publish it not, conceal the matter. It ought not to be spoken about. Why? Well, because the verse goes on to say, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. And we know, of course, from Exodus chapter 15 in verses 20 to 21 that it was the custom of the women to celebrate the victories of their armies. Remember, Miriam went out with all the women and they sang and danced before the victories of the armies of Israel. It was exactly the same with the Philistines. The women of the Philistines went out and published the victories of their warriors. David says, we don't want that to happen. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. And David obviously uses a term here that he knew Jonathan would approve of, wouldn't he? The uncircumcised. Because that's, of course, how Jonathan had always felt about the Philistines, hadn't he? Let us go over under the garrison of these uncircumcised, was the cry of Jonathan in chapter 14. And it was that same spirit that had bound him to David when David said, who are these uncircumcised that they should defy the armies of the living God in chapter 17? And David uses that term almost as if in salute to his friend here. He uses a term that he knew that Jonathan would approve of. He knew that that's how Jonathan felt about those not in the truth. Those outside of the truth. They are the uncircumcised, not in covenant relationship. And you see, part of the bitterness of this defeat lay in the fact that Israel had been overthrown by the uncircumcised. What bitterness was there in that? Something that ought not to be. And the lesson of verse 20 is that the tragedies of the truth ought not to be told to the Gentiles. And there are times in ecclesial life where we have problems and tragedies within our own personal lives and ecclesial situations. And sometimes those that are not in the truth somehow seem to find out all about what's going on in the ecclesia. Tell it not in Gath, is the cry of David. It ought never to be the case. The problems of ecclesial life should remain in the ecclesia, lest the truth be evil spoken of. And if we are to take up the spirit of David, the spirit is that we ought to contain those things, to cover them over, to conceal them, to hide them away, to press on to good and better things. And then in verse 21, we have David's bitter imprecation over the fateful heights of Gilboa. Ye mountains of Gilboa, he says, and you really ought to take away all the italics in verse 21 because they really don't help the sense, you see. It should be, ye mountains of Gilboa, no dew, neither rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away. The shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. Should delete all the italics in verse 21. And you see, in this first section, ye mountains of Gilboa, no dew, no rain, no fields of offerings upon you. David, as it were, almost calls down a curse upon the fateful heights of Gilboa. He calls in the land itself to share in mourning. That's what he's really doing. He asks the land to take its share in the mourning for this tragedy. He suggests that the scene of such a national disaster should ever remain unvisited and unblessed. And the rain and the dew, of course, are the symbols of divine blessing. It's a place, says David, that ought to be left eternally barren. There shouldn't even be fields of offerings. You know, if you turn to Joel chapter 1 for a moment, we read of the circumstances of the famine in the days of Joel. In Joel chapter 1, and this is perceived by the prophet as the worst tragedy that could befall the land. Joel 1 and verse 9 says, "The meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of Yahweh. The priests, Yahweh's ministers, mourn. The field is wasted. The land mourneth, for the corn is wasted. The new wine is dried up. The oil languisheth. Be ashamed, O ye husbandmen. Howl, O ye vine dressers, for the wheat and for the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished. The vine is dried up, and the fig tree languisheth. The pomegranate tree and the palm tree and the apple tree, all the trees of the field are withered because joy is withered away from the sons of men. Gird yourselves and lament, ye priests. Howl, ye ministers of the altar. Come, lie all night in sackcloth, for the meat offering and the drink offering is withholden from the house of your God." And the worst fate that could befall, as it were, the land of Israel was that the land itself might be cut off from rendering service to God in bringing forth the fruits for God's house. That's a tragedy, says Joel chapter 1. That the land itself can no longer bring forth fruits for God's house. That's what David calls down upon Gilboa's heights. That it ought no longer to participate in that as a memorialization of the dreadful tragedy that occurred upon its heights. And then in the balance of verse 21 he says, "For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil." Now you see, that's exactly how the original reads. Rotherham translates that phrase, "the shield of Saul unanointed with oil." Now when you actually look at the original Hebrew, you'll find that the grammatical construction would allow for two different applications, and it all depends how you read it. Let's just read it two different ways. "The shield of Saul unanointed with oil." How could we read that? Well, one way would be, "the shield of Saul unanointed with oil." That is, the shield was not anointed. The other way would be to say, "the shield of Saul unanointed with oil." That is, that the king was unanointed. And the grammar of the Hebrew would allow for either construction to be made. And in a sense, it doesn't really matter. But we do know this, that the word anoint is generally applied to persons. And in the first and second books of Samuel, it's always applied to the king. And therefore, the better rendering of the phrase would appear to be that it's the shield of he, Saul, who was not anointed with oil. And of course he was anointed, but what the verse is saying is that Saul shared the common fate of the soldier in the end as though he had never, ever been anointed with oil. He shared in the common death of his army as though he had never, ever been set apart as Yahweh's anointed. That's the final tragedy of Saul's death, isn't it? And even if we take it the other way, that it's the shield that wasn't anointed with oil, and they certainly did anoint their shields, it doesn't really matter because the shield really only stands as a symbol for the man anyway. His shield was unanointed with oil. He died in the end as a common man. In verse 22, David warmly remembers the personal bravery and courage of both father and son upon the battlefield. And so he says, "From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword The sword of Saul returned not empty. From the blood of the slain and the fat of the mighty. And we have a very vivid word picture here. If you come back to Deuteronomy chapter 32 for a moment, we have the same picture given to us in Moses' Song of Witness. And here's the picture that David seems to be drawing in this story. In Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 42, Moses' Song of Witness put it this way. He says there, in very vivid language, I will make mine arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh. So the arrows, as it were, drink the blood of their enemies, and the sword eats the flesh. And it's those two phrases that are being taken up now by David in this Song of Lament, from the blood of the slain and the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back and the sword of Saul returned not empty. And you see, when you read verse 22 carefully, there's a Hebrew parallelism there, isn't there? Just the same as verse 20. Read verse 20 again. See the parallelism? Tell it not in Gath, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. You see how that A goes with C and B goes with D in the Hebrew parallelism? Well, it's the same here in verse 22. So we should read verse 22. From the blood of the slain, the bow of Jonathan turned not back. And from the fat of the mighty, the sword of Saul returned not empty. So the bow of Jonathan was made to drink the blood of the slain and his arrows. And the sword of Saul, as it were, was sent forth to devour the flesh and the fat of the mighty. And David here therefore speaks in vivid language of the tremendous bravery and courage of both Jonathan and Saul. But what he does do in verse 22 is he graciously overlooks the difference in their motivations. Because those two men went out to battle with two different principles in mind. And they stood at the end upon Gilboa's heights for two entirely different reasons. One, because he was totally committed to doing that which was best for the truth. The other, because he was obsessively committed to upholding his own personal position in life. And David graciously overlooks the difference of the spirit behind the two men and simply comments favourably on the bravery of both of them. Although you'll notice this, that he discreetly gives Jonathan the more prominent position. You notice that? Because you see, what he says is that the bow of Jonathan turned not back from going into battle, whereas of Saul, he says, that he didn't leave the battle without some result. And so he attributes the greater role, as it were, to the brave spirit of Jonathan that never hesitated to go into the battle, and of Saul that before he left the battle that he'd always had some result as well. So David, in his discreet way, whilst he memorialises the bravery of both men, gives a little prominence more to Jonathan, his friend. And then in verse 23 he says, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. And that phrase, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, expresses the mutual affection that really did exist between father and son. But who was it who preserved the relationship? It was Jonathan, wasn't it? Who was it that kept father and son together? To the very end, it was Jonathan. And so when David here memorialises the lovely and pleasant attitude between father and son, in a way, again, the greater commendation is being given to Jonathan because he was the one who had preserved that relationship as part of his loyalty to his father. Rotherhams translates the phrase, Saul and Jonathan, delightfully loving in their lives, even in their death, were not divided. Do you know what David's really saying when he says those words? In their death, they were not divided. David's saying,
that he now understands what Jonathan had done in standing with his father. That's what he's saying. I understand what Jonathan did. I understand there was no other way. You see, Jonathan wasn't able to tell David in the woods what his own personal fears were. How could he? How could he tell David? When he'd gone there to comfort his friend, even though in his heart of hearts he knew that things might not turn out well, but David understands now. He says, I understand what he did. And I know why he stood with his father, that my cause and my house might be advanced. I understand, says David. In death they were not divided. And again we have, therefore, David's salute, as it were, to the selfless devotion of his friend. They were, he says, swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. And again, the symbols that he uses here are generous ones that describe their prowess as the nation's foremost warriors. There were no two men that were better warriors in Israel, says David, and you ought never to forget that. And he characterizes them for the sheer, whistling, bullet-like speed of the diving evil, and the life, terrifying, ferocious, pouncing strength of the lion that nothing can stop. He says that's what they were like. Irresistible and swift upon the battlefield. Don't forget that, Israel, says David. And then in verse 24, ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. And you see, you'll remember, if we come back to the 1 Samuel chapter 18 for a moment, you'll remember this record. You see, in the 1 Samuel chapter 18, in verse 6, it says that it came to pass, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And David now calls upon the same daughters of Israel that once celebrated the victories of Saul and shared in the spoils of his victory to now join in personal lamentation for his loss. We're told in Jeremiah chapter 9 and verses 17 to 20 that the women led the lamentations for those who had died. And David calls upon the women of Israel to remember their king. They had sung for his victories. They should lament for his death. And what he reminds them of in the 24th verse is that, you see, at least Saul's work had bound the nation together into an organized kingdom. It was only the beginnings of those things. But at least Saul had accomplished that. We're told in the 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verses 47 and 48 that Saul's wars were numerous and successful. He'd waged many battles on behalf of the nation, and as a result of that, the nation had been economically and materially enriched. David couldn't really say that the nation had been spiritually enriched, could he, under the reign of Saul? But at least he could find something good to say about Saul. At least economically, the nation was better off as a result of the first king that sat upon the throne. At least remember that, says David. At least remember that the nation was better off in material things because of the reign of Saul your king. And you see what David's doing in verse 24? He doesn't criticize Saul. He focuses on the good. Stanley, writing on this, says, there is no revengeful feeling in David at the death of his persecutor, but brighter recollections. Recollections where he speaks only of Saul of earlier times, the mighty conqueror, the delight of his people, the father of his beloved and faithful friend. And David focuses on that which is good, that might be recalled in the earlier happy times of Saul's reign, and he bids the nation remember their king in that way.
Remember that the nation benefited in some way from the life and from the kingship of Saul. Don't ever forget that, says David. You see what he does in this verse, brothers and sisters? He doesn't criticize Saul. He focuses on his good. He remembers the happier times of Saul's reign. He bids the nation remember their king in that way. Now, who nurtured that spirit in David, that he should see the positive in people? But Jonathan's friend. You see, I think that this is David paying homage to Jonathan by manifesting his friend's character. He knew how Jonathan would want him to remember his father. Stanley says in one of his writings, "No revengeful feeling is here by David at the death of his persecutor, but brighter recollections of the departed. He speaks only of Saul of earlier times, the mighty conqueror, the delight of his people, the father of his beloved and faithful friend. And he remembers Saul in the most positive and happy of ways. And he bids Israel remember the departed king in that way." That was a marvelous spirit, wasn't it, brothers and sisters, to remember good in others. That was Jonathan who had taught him that principle. Verse 25, "How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle?" See, here's our refrain again from verse 19, but extended now. "Aik nafalu giborim, beitok kamil kamar." O Jonathan, he says. And now we come to finally the thing that David has held back for the whole of this song so far, but now it comes forth. The deepest grief, the sharpest hurt, reserved now till the end. The choking cry of David as he remembers his friend lying dead on Gilboa. "O Jonathan," he says, "thou wast slain in thine high places." And you know, brothers and sisters, the high places I think that David has in mind is not just the heights of Gilboa. I think what he's thinking of in verse 25 is that the high places here symbolize the heights of faith and selflessness to which Jonathan had risen. You see, here was a man, his friend, who had the loftiest of ideals. He wanted the best for the truth. He wanted to give the utmost in loyalty. He wanted to show the finest of standards. He gave the highest of service. He wanted the best in integrity. And finally, Jonathan lost his life because of his commitment to his own high places in the truth. Is that not what David laments here? "Thou wast slain upon thine own high places, O Jonathan." And so he was, brothers and sisters, on his own high places, did this man give his life. Verse 26. "I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful." You see that word pleasant there, brothers and sisters? You know that that's actually a cognate word based from the same Hebrew root of a very famous psalm that would later be written by David. And it would use these words: "Behold how good and how pleasant a thing it is for brethren to dwell together in unity." Now, where's that from? Can anyone give me the psalm? Psalm 133, absolutely correct. Let's just have a look at that briefly, shall we? Because, you see, this is a word that I think is lifted out of the lamentation of the Song of the Bow and turns up later on. It's not exactly the same word, but it's drawn from the same Hebrew root. And just look at the contrast here as we come to Psalm 133, in a psalm that David later on would write about the glorious privileges of friendship in the truth. He knew about this, didn't he? And so he says in Psalm 133, verse 1, Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. It is like the precious ointment upon the beard, the head rather, that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard that went down to the skirts of his garments, as the dew of Hermon that descended upon the mountains of Zion, for there Yahweh commanded the blessing, even life forevermore. And you see the contrast, brothers and sisters, between the Song of the Bow and Psalm 133, because in the Song of the Bow, Gilboa's heights are left forever bereft of dew, to symbolize the death of his dear friend whose love was pleasant. But in Psalm 133, the mountains of Zion are forever bathed in dew to symbolize the eternal life and fellowship of those who will enjoy the pleasantness of brotherly unity in the age to come. Marvelous contrast there, brothers and sisters, as he writes that psalm. 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 26 again then. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of woman. And I suppose at the end of the day, brothers and sisters, that really is the last thing that we should look at, isn't it? In terms of the principles of true friendship, Jonathan showed love. Whatever else he showed, it could be summarized surely in this one key word. Remember these beautiful words in the 1st of Corinthians. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself. Is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly. Seeketh not her own. Is not easily provoked. Thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love never faileth. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, says David. And isn't that the greatest principle of friendship that David showed to his friend, that Jonathan rather showed to his friend? He showed David the spirit of love that should be that which the disciples manifest towards the Messiah. And interesting what it says, you see, in the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 1, verse 26, thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. I think there are two things I want to say about that little phrase. First is that there was a strange contrast, you know, in the one family, because you realize that David married Jonathan's sister, don't you? Whose name was Michal. And David never ever did find a unity of mind with Saul's daughter, did he? But he found kinship, strangely enough, with Saul's son. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. And David experienced that out of the one house, the house of Saul, a kinship with a son that was not matched by an affinity with a daughter of the same man, although he had married her. Remarkable thing. And the other thing I wanted to say about that expression was simply this, brothers and sisters, that we live in a world, a dreadful world, an impure and profane world, where some would be suspicious of this friendship between two men. And we want to say that this was a love and a friendship that was based on the purest and noblest of motives. We ought to rest in that purity, such as the Bible describes and presents this story to us. It is nothing more than that, than the highest of friendships, based upon a spiritual love of divine principles. In fact, you know this, that the word beauty in this song, and the word mighty in this song, and the word dew, and the word oil, and the word shield, and the word lovely, and the word pleasant, and the word love, all of those words drawn out of this song find their way into the Song of Solomon. and a poem that David's son would write about the relationship between Christ and his disciples, that great friendship that is described in the Bible as a marriage of Christ and his bride. All these words are used to describe the affinity that the ecclesia will one day show with Christ, even as Jonathan and David had that affinity in the days of their earthly life. Verse 27, how are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? And so now we have the key refrain of the lament, now finally augmented into a full couplet of grief and despair. Aik nafalu gibborim, vayabadu kili milchama. The weapons of war are perished, cries David. And the weapons of war are perished in verse 27, brothers and sisters, quite simply because they that once wielded the weapons are dead. And the weapons are a symbol of those who used them. And the weapons are perished because the men lie still upon the mountain slope. So this is David's lamentation of farewell for his friend, the friend whom he remembered with such love and affection. And isn't this really a study, brothers and sisters, perhaps more than anything else, upon the principles of friendship? I hope we've taken a note of those, because they're the principles that we will be able to use to nourish our own friendships in the truth. And what were they? Let me just recollect them to your memory. The need for like-mindedness. The need to show esteem of other better than self. The need, brothers and sisters, to be fervent in our friendships. Let fervent love be among you all. The need to show comfort to one another, not the granting or offering of commiserations, but the giving of those helpful things whereby we can encourage one another in the truth. The need to show loyalty. The loyalty that is constant at all times and despite all adversities. The need to keep counsel and show trust in both the giving and the receiving of secrets. The need to give good counsel. Those helpful words of advice and wisdom whereby we nourish the soul of our friend. The principle of self-denial, so that we might always think of the cause of the other and do that which shall best advance their cause. And here today, in our closing study, finally, a principle that really embraces them all, doesn't it? The principle of love, by which all friendships finally are brought to their perfection. You know, if there was one characteristic that we have not yet said concerning Jonathan, but really perhaps was his most outstanding, it has to be this, brothers and sisters, that he was a man of humility. And I think therein lay his secret. It was humility that allowed Jonathan to grasp the lesson of Gideon. That's something we didn't look at, by the way, through lack of time. But do you know that when Jonathan climbed that cliff in the 1st of Samuel 14, that he fulfilled the spirit of Gideon perfectly and wonderfully, and he learnt to be empty enough of self so that he could truly trust in his God? It was humility that prompted Jonathan to esteem a lad and gladly offer his symbols of rank in token of loyalty. It was humility that made Jonathan plead for his friend's loving kindness when his friend had just asked for his. It was humility that moved Jonathan to earnestly plead his friend's cause and to grieve at shame done to him. It was humility that led Jonathan to cast his lot with his father's decline rather than with his friend's rise. And it was humility that caused Jonathan to bow before Yahweh's will, even when it meant his own diminishing. He was, brothers and sisters, a remarkable man, was he not? A truly remarkable man, as the divine record paints him. So let us summarize then the spirit of our study this day. And in summarizing this study, of course, we come to our concluding thought upon this man. Jonathan the Mighty. True humility of spirit will cause us to bow before God's appointments, even when they involve our own diminishing. The disciples' spirit with regard to Christ should always be, "He must increase, but I must decrease." True friendship is agape love, the love that bears, believes, hopes, and endures all things. Jonathan exhibited that selfless love by losing himself completely in a consuming eagerness to further his friend's cause, excelling in courage, yet abounding in humility, fervent in friendship, yet strong in honour, fearless in entreaty, yet tender in counsel. He was a mighty man in the truth, Jonathan, given of Yahweh, which, by the way, is what his name means. Did you know that? Given of Yahweh, Yahonathan. And he was given, wasn't he, as a friend to David. And when David came to the kingship, a better and more mature and wiser man, much of what he'd learnt and much of what he would apply in his rulership on the throne was because of this marvellous, marvellous friendship he had from a man that was given to him as a gift and as a friend, this man, Jonathan, whose love was wonderful.